This interview with Woolston Fletcher took place on November 9, 2019 in Rhinebeck, New York. It contains four segments. In segment one, he talks about Mipham and the Nyingma approach to Buddha nature. In segment two, he describes Longchenpa's views on Buddha nature. In part three, he describes his personal encounter with the Buddha nature teachings. And in the final segment, he offers a definition of Buddha nature.
One of the things that Mipham Rinpoche says at the beginning of The Lion's Roar on the Buddha nature is that, you know, after saying that that this doctrine is actually the heart of all the teachings of the Sutra and the Tantras and the intention of the all the victorious ones and so on, he goes on to talk about the difficulty of the doctrine. Saying that it is so subtle that, in fact, even bodhisattvas on the 10th ground can't fully understand it. So no need to talk about ordinary beings. And I think one of the things he's referring to is that when you look at the different statements that are made about the Buddha nature, and you try to examine them from the point of view of ordinary reason and common sense, you're faced with paradox. And of course, there are ways of coming to grips with this, but it's a complicated subject, and a bit like Madhyamaka, the doctrine of the Buddha nature has been controversial in Tibet, which is not surprising when you have something that is subtle and profound. Different people will have different approaches. So, although you know, there may be disagreements, I think generally Mipham's approach to this is that, you know, in different situations and with different kinds of people, different kinds of doctrines are appropriate. So it's not necessarily ground for denigrating the position of others. so, you know, you could talk generally, very generally, about Buddha nature in a kind of touchy-feely way. Or you can try to deal with these philosophical complexities. One way into this question, from a Nyingma point of view, is to see how Longchenpa approaches the second and the third turning of the Dharma wheel, the teachings of Madhyamaka on the one hand, Yogacara on the other, emptiness, Buddha nature, and so on, which is, of course, upheld by Mipham, which is to say that in the Nyingma school, instead of having a kind of disjunctive approach to these two turnings and saying one is definitive and the other is provisional, the second is definitive, the third is provisional, or vice versa. The characteristic stance of Longchenpa is to say that they are not separable, and that if one understands the second and the third turning properly, when they are brought into union, so to speak, they are both definitive. And if you separate them, they are both provisional. So this kind of, in other words, Buddha nature, well, in addition to that, Buddha nature could be viewed from the point of view of the second turning or the point of view of the third turning, and that the truth of the matter transcends the separation of these two approaches. and then, but before going on, I'd like just to say something brief about the Nyingma attitude to the teaching of the Yogacara, right? You know, like other Madhyamakas, Nyingmapas consider, in their own particular way, the supremacy of the Prasangika approach in Madhyamaka. But at the same time, I suppose, in part because of their kind of their allegiance to the teaching of Kenpo Bodhisattva Shantarakshita, there is this certain openness to the Yogacara position. And in the scholastic tradition, among the Nyingmapas, they make a very important distinction between what they call the scriptural mind-only and the mind-only as a tenet system, the Kaya Samsam, Trupte Samsam. And the Kaya Samsam is basically the teachings on the Buddha nature that you find in the scriptures, in which you will not find the Buddha ever saying that the mind is ultimately an ultimate truth. This only comes when the mind-only school kind of crystallizes into a tenet system. And that statement that the mind is truly existent is the one thing that the Madhyamakas disapprove of. They don't disapprove of anything else in it. So therefore the conclusion of that approach is to say that the view of the scriptural mind only is not inferior to the Madhyamaka view. Now, this kind of openness to mind-only language, shall we say, means that very often you will find Longchenpa, when he's talking about the phenomenal world, he will use language which is very, very typical of Yogacara, especially the the false aspectarian Yogacaras. And on the other hand, Mipham carries on this approach and actually says in his commentary to the Majjhima Lankara that when we come to dealing with the relative truth, by which he means ordinary life, the view of mind only is certainly the best way to approach it. This naturally leads into, it makes a very comfortable bridge between the sutra teachings and the tantra, and especially the great perfection where, the phenomenal world is considered to be the display of the mind, the luminosity aspect. So there is a kind of mentalist kind of understanding, shall we say, of the phenomenal experience. Having said that, when you sort of, you can consider, for instance, the doctrine of the two truths, the ultimate truth, or the doctrine of the Buddha nature, and so on. And of course, from our point of view, from the point of view of ordinary beings, this is something that we are taught. It's not something that we naturally understand. If the Nagarjuna had not said so, or if the teachings had not said so, we would never have guessed that there was such a thing as ultimate truth. We would do what everybody else does and consider the relative truth as ultimately real. It's only a kind of it's a teaching. It's a kind. It's a sort of revelation, if you like, where you are being told about something that you don't perceive. Similarly, with the Buddha nature, we don't experience the Buddha nature. We experience phenomena. We don't experience the nature of the mind. We experience Namtok. We don't experience the ultimate truth. We experience the relative truth. And so we are, as it were, coping with this idea from the point of view of somebody who is deeply wrapped up in the cocoon of ignorance, and we're using ordinary mind to try and come to grips with that and to call into question precisely those aspects of life that seem so real, that, you know. When, for instance, Mipham Rinpoche is talking about the two truths, he makes a distinction between two kinds of ultimate truth, the figurative ultimate and the non-figurative ultimate. The figurative ultimate being actually the idea of the ultimate that you listen, you hear about and you think about, which is, as it were, in opposition to the relative truth. And it's important to have a kind of intellectual understanding of this figurative ultimate, but it's not the ultimate in itself. The figurative ultimate is an idea that can be known by the ordinary mind. The ultimate truth in itself is an experience in which the mind actually ceases to be ordinary. So it's the ultimate truth, they say, is actually the union of the two truths. The ultimate truth in itself is the union of the two truths. And many, on many occasions in the discussion about the Buddha nature, whenever you come to kind of binary oppositions, the correct position is actually something that transcends both poles of the you know, the both polarities. So, for instance, they talk about the Buddha nature being permanent. But this permanence is not ordinary permanence in opposition to impermanence. It's a permanence that transcends permanence and impermanence. You know, it's uncompounded because it transcends both compounded and uncompounded. It's the great uncompounded, right? In The Lion's Roar, what Mipham does is to consider two possible extreme positions, which he says has been propounded by masters in the past, and to define the Nyingma position in relation to those two views. One is that the Buddha nature is a truly existent entity, and the other that Buddha nature is just emptiness. In other words, the Buddha nature as a truly existent entity that is possessed with all the qualities of enlightenment but is a real thing, that's going too far from Mipham's point of view. On the other hand, the idea that Buddha nature is just emptiness, then that is not enough, because the position is that if the Buddha nature is the kind of position of saying the Buddha nature is emptiness is that it is just a potential, and that the qualities of enlightenment are produced, on the path through the accumulations of merit and wisdom. And so, in other words, the Buddha nature is in a sense compounded, and so that is not okay either. So the characteristic position in Nyingma, which I think is the same in Kagyu, is that the Buddha nature is uncompounded, is unchanging, is endowed with the qualities of enlightenment primordially from the very beginning, and the whole path, but it is concealed by adventitious obscuration, both the emotional veil and the cognitive veil, and the path is actually a process of removing those adventitious impurities, so that when the Buddha nature, when Buddhahood is finally achieved, the Buddha nature stands fully revealed, but is not in any way different from the Buddha nature at the level of an ascension being, where it is concealed by obscuration. So, to use a technical term, they would say that the Buddha nature and the state of non-enlightenment is what they call a drelgyu. That is, it is the cause of the removal. That's to say that it's like a window. You know, the window in itself is perfectly pure, and it is blocked by dirt on the window. The fact that the window is pure in itself means that it can be cleaned. So it's the cause of, through the removal of the dirt. So it's the cause of removal. And then when that is done and the window is perfectly clean again, it is the jeldre, it is a fruit or a result that has come through the removal of adventitious defilement. Now, there are some kind of arguments that Mipham uses based on ordinary common sense, which can to some extent dispel some of the mistaken views, philosophical views, about the Buddha nature. One of them is to examine the relation between cause and effect, and to say that whereas you can have a cause, but it's not certain that the cause will have an effect, like the seed. It's not certain that the seed will grow because it might get burnt or something. On the other hand, if you have an effect, you know of a certainty that there has been a cause. And so he will say that since we know that there are enlightened beings in which they, you know, the full enlightenment is fully developed, that itself must have had a cause. In other words, a potential in the mind stream of that person which was able to blossom into enlightenment. And then the scriptures say that this ultimate state is uncompounded. Since it is uncompounded, it must be immutable. Since it is immutable, it must be already perfect, even in the seed stage. So you can use kind of arguments like that. but he will say that, in fact, many of the paradoxical features of the Buddha nature, it doesn't mean, the fact that they're paradoxical doesn't mean to say that they can't be understood by beings. But what he does is, what he talks about is the kind of valid cognition that is based on pure vision. The valid cognition that we use, valid cognition is based on perception, right? And so our ordinary perceptions of the world form the basis of a whole system of valid cognition. And on that level, what they call the Surtan Kishepa, the kind of understanding on this side of things, there are things about the Buddha nature that can't be explained, like the sort of understanding of valid cognition propounded by Dharmakirti is not sufficient to understand the some of the paradoxical features of Buddha nature, but it is possible for the valid cognition based on pure vision, which is the kind of experience that bodhisattvas on the bhumis have when they are in post-meditation. You know, like you see in the Sancho Mernlam, for instance, when it talks about, you know, countless Buddha fields on the grain of dust and so on. And this is actually something that beings on the bhumis actually are able to perceive. And on that level, that kind of the kind of valid cognition based on that sort of experience is sufficient to explain the paradoxical aspects of the Buddha nature. For instance, how is it possible for an uncompounded nature to cognize objects? Because cognition, as we understand it, necessarily involves change. things like that. And so, although Mipham is always extremely rigorous in the way he reasons about things, and has an extraordinary capacity to bring things into focus and in relation to each other, he does say that in the last analysis, much of what is said about the Buddha nature is really an object of faith for ordinary beings. And so he can quote the scriptures where the Buddha tells the Gelongs, you know, you don't see this, but I do, and so you can take my word for it. Things like this. Yes, Longchenpa's in a way more difficult because, of course, he's writing at a much earlier period. And he has a sort of poetic way of expressing himself, whereas Mipham is easier. It's more kind of systematic. Longchenpa often uses quite difficult terms, and the way he sort of different categories. So that, for instance, in the in the section on the Tathagata Garbha in the Shinto Chenpo, which is the auto commentary to the mind, finding rest in the nature of the mind. He talks about, in fact, I've got the term here. He makes a distinction between in two kinds of rig. I may as well say that translating texts on Buddha nature is very complicated because we don't have obviously acceptable terms that capture really the word gotra in Sanskrit, rig in Tibetan, or kam or nyingpo and so on. So we oscillate between potential or the element or, the nature and so on and so forth. We're talking about the same thing, but from different, slightly different aspects. So he makes a distinction between the rangshin nepirig, the naturally present potential, meaning the Buddha nature as it is present in the stage of sentient beings, and the drupirig, which is the Buddha nature that is made manifest through the accomplishment of the path, the deldre, the fruit that is the fruition that comes about through the removal of adventitious veils. And then Longchenpa, he loves subtle fine distinctions, so he divides the rangshin the rangshin nepirig into two. He talks about the Chenye Rangshinto Nepirig and the Chechen Rangshinto Nepirig. And the Chenye Rangshinto Nepirig is actually two aspects. These two distinctions are two aspects of the rig, of the potential, the nature. The Chechen is the Chenye is from the emptiness aspect, and the Chechen Rangshinto Nepirig is from the appearance aspect. So immediately, Longchenpa starts to talk about the Buddha nature very much from the point of view of the great perfection. And so and this is always in the background. His understanding of Madhyamaka, his understanding of the Buddha nature is always from this point of view. And of course, this is taken up by Mipham himself. That actually brings us back to the relationship between the second and the third turning of the Dharma wheel, because when people talk about the Buddha nature, they think the Buddha nature teaching is just a matter of the third turning, and it is in opposition to the Madhyamaka of the second turning. Whereas if you see from this point of view, from Longchenpa's point of view, the second turning is actually the emptiness aspect of the Buddha nature, and the third turning is the appearance aspect of the Buddha nature. And so the two, that's why the two are actually inseparable. So it is sometimes said, for instance, that when you're talking about the practice of the Buddha nature or the teaching of the Buddha nature, on the level of the sutras, it's mentioned. It's even implied in Madhyamaka, where the ultimate truth in itself is what is called as the absence, what's defined as the absence of mental elaboration, tredral, as distinct from the megak that is propounded by some other schools. From the Nyingma point of view, and I think from the Kagyu point of view too, the ultimate truth in itself is this state of the absence of mental elaboration, which comes about through the simultaneous refutation of the four extremes, the tetralemma, Nagarjuna's tetralemma. When that happens and the mind ceases to be ordinary, that is the Buddha nature. Tredral is the Buddha nature. Tredral is the nature of the mind. Tredral is primordial wisdom. Sorry, the Buddha nature is primordial wisdom. Right. It's kind of stated, it's implied. And also, in the sutra level of the third turning, it is not that developed. I mean, even in a text like the Gulama, it's descriptive. But it doesn't actually, as far as I understand, it doesn't actually lead you into the experience of this. I mean, could be if it were taught by, in a certain way by a teacher. On the level of the Tantra, it is much more the way to activate the Buddha nature is more explicit, where the Buddha nature is actually identified with the Shigyu, the ground Tantra. And and on the level of the Great Perfection, it is explained in great detail. And so you have, on the one hand, the emptiness aspect. On the other hand, you have the luminosity aspect of the Buddha nature. The emptiness aspect is activated in the practice of Trikcha. The luminosity aspect is activated in the practice of Togal, where you have, it leads you into a direct vision or a direct experience of what is in fact the Buddha nature. Well, I mean, I came to Buddhism from a tradition that propounds the real existence of phenomena and talks in terms of a soul or a self, a god, and so on and so forth, all of which are actually closely connected. And so, for me, seeing the teachings of the Buddha nature right at the beginning was confusing, because from the way people sometimes talk about Buddha nature, it sounds like we're getting back to the self, or we're getting back to, the eternal soul, and so on. And so, for me, the study of Madhyamaka has been extremely valuable. And one can see, actually, at least for a person like me, Madhyamaka has been an excellent preparatory step. And you realize that actually the true understanding of Buddha nature is impossible unless you approach it through the kind of emptiness doctrine that you find in Madhyamaka. That, as Longchenpa will say, even the ground itself is an illusion. There is nothing that you can actually put your finger on as being really existent. And then, having said that, I found that, so that was on the kind of intellectual level, which is, I think, very important, to get the view right. From the level of practice, however, I found the teaching of the Buddha nature very important, even though I have scratched the surface only. And so I remember being told, it was actually, it happened when the Dalai Lama first came to Dordogne in 91 to teach the Bodhicaryavatara. And somebody had this bright idea of having hot air balloons with prayer flags attached, so they would be floating around in the air. So we were asked to kind of come up with some sort of explanation of what prayer flags are. And so I went and had a long conversation with Jigme Khyentse Rinpoche. And he said, throughout one's kind of journey through samsara, a specific being or a mind stream will do something which is what we will call a virtue. And or then this virtue will have the effect of lessening the obscurations on the Buddha nature. And so the idea is that going back to, the mind-only approach to the relative truth, the inner experience and the outer universe that you perceive are directly connected. And so, in proportion that you do virtuous things, virtue, of course, being in inverted commas, the Buddha nature becomes more apparent. And of course, the case of different beings, the veils on the Buddha nature will be thick or thin, depending on their, you know, their sort of samsaric career kind of thing, what they've managed to accomplish. So it's like, you know, it's like what Chandrakirti says in the Madhyamaka Vatara. He says there are some people who, when they just hear emptiness, they hear the teachings on wisdom, they start to cry. Their skin stands up. You know, it shows that they are vessels for the teaching. So that they're, in those cases, they are, you know, the Buddha nature is already being activated. And even before that time, as the Buddha nature is activated, the different sort of emblems of the Dharma begin to constellate in the outer experience. So for some people, in this occasion, talking about the Dalai Lama's coming, this will be the first time they see a prayer flag. That means that the prayer flag is actually a manifestation of the Buddha nature. You know, the Buddha nature sort of begins to appear to you. And first of all, it's like things that sort of make you cry, things that sort of move you, like, you know, you might see the Dalai Lama and, you know, has this enormous effect. And eventually you will have the right kind of body and intelligence and situation where you can actually hear the teachings themselves. And eventually you will meet the teachings in the form of a teacher, that you will actually meet somebody who you can connect with and who can guide you on the path. That again is the Buddha nature. And then eventually you will meet a master who can actually point out your Buddha nature. And that's the sort of last, you have the appearances of the Dharma on one side, the Buddha nature coming to the surface on the other, and they eventually coincide in the point where the nature is introduced. And when that nature is recognized, then two things happen. You actually see the nature of the mind, and you actually see the teacher as Buddha. In many Lamtars, you have this. This event is actually described, whether the yogini sees the teacher as being Buddha. So that whole kind of on the level of practice, you see, even something as comparatively simple as Guru Yoga is precisely a practice which is bringing out, is developing the Buddha nature from within. And then, you know, in the higher teachings in Trekcha and Togal, for instance, or the visualizations of the Kerim and so on, and practices of Dzogchen, they're all doing this. They're all kind of bringing the, activating the Buddha nature, which is deeply hidden in the mind. From my point of view, that the Buddha nature has been, it's on the level of the practice, on the level of it's. Whereas Madhyamaka has been very important intellectually, as a kind of preparation for that.
So, if you were to encounter my grandmother, and she asked, "Well, what is Buddha nature?"
It's the deepest and truest aspect of yourself. Of course, self may be a controversial word to use, but it's not controversial in that stage if you're talking to somebody. And even though you may not realize it, you have within you this kind of wellspring of goodness and strength and wisdom that you don't have to look anywhere else for it. It's already there. What you need to do is get out of the way so that, and the fact that, already the fact that talking to the grandmother, the fact that you want to be happy, the fact that you don't want to suffer, that is already a sign that there is something If the Buddha nature were not there, you would just be inert, like a rock, and it wouldn't make it, suffering would make no difference, happiness would make no difference. The fact that you make this distinction is already a sign. This desire for happiness is already a sign that the Buddha nature is there. So the question then is to understand what happiness is and to understand how to get it. I remember being very moved by something that my teacher, Tukapa Mwangyal, once said to me, that very often when he's giving public teachings, there are huge lines of people who go up to talk to him. And a lot of the time, I suspect it's not asking technical questions about the practice, but just pouring out their troubles. And you have people who are in a terrible state of suffering, illness, fear, broken marriages, and so on, and they're crying, and there's nothing you can do or he can do to change it. In practical terms. And so I asked him, how do you cope? How come you're not overwhelmed by all this sorrow? And he said, when I'm in front of somebody who is like that and is in a lot of pain, and especially when I can't do anything direct to change it, I meditate on their Buddha nature. And I remind myself that within them, the most basic reality is beyond the suffering that they are now experiencing. They're already in a state of bliss, perfection. And even that, I suppose, the usefulness of thinking like that is to remind you that, in fact, however bad it seems, it's just adventitious. It can be removed. It's not the reality in itself. So I try to do, I tried when I'm talking to people who are in difficulty, I try to remind, well, I think of that myself, but also I try to remind them or try to tell them that, everything, because we cling to self, because we cling to reality, what is happening to us seems permanent, seems definitive, seems to be there forever. But it isn't. It's a kind of passing nightmare. And we, it is possible to wake up from it.